G'day, I am Rabbi Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Karsh.
And welcome to Two Rabbis and a Podcast. And today, I guess it's a little bit of a continuation of our discussion about exotic, ancient, fascinating books last week. We are moving on to a discussion about two things. A, the Cairo Geniza. And B, what was the other topic?
Well, it's whether information that is taken from there's a word there. I'm looking for the word. Information.
Archaeology.
Yes.
Archaeology.
Yes. So can halachic matters be resolved using archaeology? Has it ever happened? For instance, with Genizas or the Dead Sea Scrolls or things like that, has it ever happened that there was an outstanding kind of unresolved halachic issue that was considered resolved because of it? Or did people try to resolve it and there was pushback, that kind of...
This is a massive subject.
Yes.
We may have to do part two.
That's perfect. That's fine.
Okay.
Although I have great faith in your ability to handle massive subjects in like a soundbite, but go ahead.
Okay. Let's begin with the Cairo Geniza.
Okay.
So as some of you may know, and some of you may not know, when you have something with the name of God or words of Torah, we don't just chuck it out. We don't just put it in the garbage or recycle it. Generally, we put it into something known as a Geniza, meaning a storehouse, a storage place, or sometimes called Shamus, shame meaning the name of God, and we put it away. Now, obviously, if Jews have been doing that for a long time, if we could find a Geniza that was used by Jews 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, etc., that would be a treasure house of information, especially if the Jews were really stringent about it and didn't just put words of Torah in there, but pretty much anything written in Hebrew script. So can you imagine 1,000 years worth of Hebrew letters and documents and manuscripts and autographed manuscripts and so on and so forth? Well, we've got it. And there's a few examples. The most famous, Cairo. So there's a synagogue, a shul in Cairo called the Ben Ezra Synagogue, built in 822, destroyed 1012, rebuilt 1025. So the current building, which has been renovated recently by the Egyptian government, dates back to 1025. And in the, I'm going to share, if that's okay.
It's very okay.
So the Ben Ezra Synagogue, which is right there, right behind me, is absolutely magnificent. And what's amazing about it, here is the woman's gallery upstairs. And here...
By the way, did you in fact visit this synagogue?
It was actually closed when I was in Egypt. So
okay.
I drove past it. I did not visit.
Okay. All right.
But just under the ceiling, as you can see, there's a hole there, up there.
A rectangular.
Yes, rectangular. Yeah, an opening.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can find a. Okay. In any case, there you see people putting stuff into the Geniza. Right. So basically, Egyptian Jews for about 1,000 years were putting manuscripts in the attic type of this synagogue. So a number of people knew about this. People outside of Egypt were aware of this. There was a guy right behind me, Solomon Wertheim from Jerusalem, who actually found some manuscripts there and published them. There was Yaakov Safir, one of the great, great, intrepid Jewish travelers of the 1800s, went all over the world. When I say all over the world, India, Sri Lanka, New Zealand, Australia, unbelievable. But he also went to Egypt.
And he wrote about it.
Yes, he wrote about it. Yes, Evan Sapir. Fascinating.
Okay.
Two volumes. It's amazing, his experiences. You imagine someone in the 1800s, a Jew from Jerusalem, traveling all over the world like that. So he went to Egypt, and I've got the quote here. After I'd labored for 2 days with covered with dust and earth, I removed a few folios of some old books and manuscripts I had chosen. I did not find anything, any valuable information in them. Who knows what lies beneath? Great words. I was tired of searching, but I certainly came across no snake or similar reptile, and thank God no harm came to me. So we've got Solomon Wertheim knew about it, Yaakov Saphir, but the great discovery and leap forward for the Gniza and bringing it to light was really Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter, who was a raised as a Hasidic Jew, Shlomo Zalman Schechter, went to England and was a reader, i.e., professor of Hebrew and Talmud at Cambridge University. He was a traditional Jew, and he was embroiled in a huge controversy with another Jew, David Margoliouth, in Oxford. Now, they hated each other with a passion for three reasons. A, Oxford and Cambridge.
Course.
B, Solomon Schechter was a traditional Jew. David Margoliouth had converted to Christianity.
That'll do it.
Number three, they had a disagreement about something called Ben Sira, which is quoted in the Gemara numerous times, known as Ecclesiasticus, in which Margoliouth said it was a Christian text that was stolen by the Jews and translated into Hebrew and Aramaic. Solomon Schechter said it was a Jewish text stolen by the Christians. And now enter into the scene two sisters teaching at Cambridge, Dr. Agnes Lewis and Dr. Margaret Gibson, who were linguists, archaeologists, and travelers, and friends of Solomon Schechter. They told him, they said, "We're going to Egypt. Can we bring you back something?" He says, "Sure, I don't know anything. Bring me back something. Bobblehead, Mo, whatever." So anyway, they go to Egypt, and in Egypt, they buy. That as a Jew in the marketplace is selling a manuscript, and what he's selling is, turns out, is the oldest fragment of the original Hebrew of Ben Sira. So he is very excited. Here's the letter that Solomon Schechter wrote to Mrs. Lewis with his, you can see, but just by the original letter, he's very excited about this. Don't speak yet about this matter. I'll come to you tomorrow at 11 p.m. and talk the matter over with you. In haste and great excitement, Solomon Schechter. So first of all, what she found there was a amazing was something which was quite incredible because it showed that he was right about Ben Sira. Because the oldest text ever found is now Hebrew. But more than that, it gave him an inkling that there might be some more stuff in Cairo. And so he's a friend of another Hebraist in Cambridge by the name of Dr. Charles Taylor, who was wealthy. Solomon Schechter was poor as a church mouse and not a good
Not
analogy.
church, that would be
A shul
Margolis,
mouse,
is a
a shul
church
mouse.
mouse.
Right,
Yeah,
yeah, he's as poor as a shul mouse.
yes.
So, but basically, Taylor finances a trip for Solomon Schechter to go to Egypt, which he does. Here is a postcard from Solomon Schechter, in which he writes how the food is terrible, and he needs a shas sent to him as soon as possible, a Vilna shas. How much will it cost? Just type of interesting to see this here. Here's a translation of his letter. Greetings to you, dear wife and family. No kosher hotel here. I'm sick of the local food. Busy with my mission all day. Please God, I'll be successful. Tell me, what's the cost of a Vilna shas on excellent paper? I'll be here all month. Write to me at the Brezza. How is our friend Robbie going? It's very interesting, right? Amongst the Jews, I found some venerable people, also some B'nai Torah. But what happens is he goes to the rabbi of the shul and he says, I want to buy the Gniza, the contents of the Gniza. So the rabbi says, on one condition, you have to arrange a trip for me and my family to the pyramids at Giza. and pay for him, pay for the marriage. So he says, okay. So he arranges for a trip. The rabbi goes to Giza, right? He's satisfied. He sees pyramids, and he sells for I don't know how much, hundreds of pounds, about 300,000 fragments of manuscripts to Solomon Schechter, which he packs up and sends to Cambridge University. There he is in the library at Cambridge University, or in the Gniza room they gave him, breathing in the mold and the fungus and the dust, and trying to figure out from 300,000 pieces what there is there.
I should just point out for those of you who are listening on Spotify or Apple, you don't get the option of seeing this. It's worth seeing it, and you can go on YouTube. You can actually watch our discussions, and this one, it's really worth it because these pictures add so much to the experience of talking about it.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I was not aware of that, but okay, that's okay. Important to know. Okay, so now eventually it got moved to this to a nicer library in Cambridge, which is now called the Taylor Schechter Gniza Research Unit at Cambridge University Library. They use a lot of high-tech stuff. Obviously, they have to process segments that they find. They have to very carefully unfold the paper. They sometimes have to even put micro dots of glue under the ink to make sure it doesn't fall off the page. They photograph things with special ultraviolet photography, which reveals the text, as you can see in the two texts above and next to me. And they have to put it together like a jigsaw puzzle almost, right? And figure out who wrote what and what is there, etc. There is Amir Ashour, scholar from Tel Aviv University, who's doing research there at the Cairo Geniza. So that's me with a good friend Aubrey Hirsch, and Amir Ashour at the Geniza in Cambridge, and it's fascinating to watch the work go on. There is our teacher Reb Moshe Shapiro. Akiva Tatz arranged for this, and he went to Cambridge to have a look at the Geniza. He was very, very fascinated by that. Here is one section. This is a Tanakh from 1215 Iran. So it's an 800-year-old piece of Tanakh, Torah, Prophets, and Writings. And the end of it, right there, it tells you who wrote it, a guy called Yosef ibn Nimrod from Gulbuddin. And Gulbuddin, I forgot where. No, somewhere, Gunbad-i-Malgan in Iran.
Gulbuddin was that
Oh,
guy,
that's
the
right.
Afghan warlord.
Yes, who looked like our friend, right?
Yes,
And
Kirishan says,
yes.
yes.
And you'll notice also just something interesting, the vowels. I don't know if you can see the cursor in the screen, on the screen here, probably not. But you'll see the vowels are all above the
Above.
text.
Yeah, cool.
That's type of interesting to see. Here is a letter about 1,000 years old from Rabbi Hushiel ben Elchanan to his relative. He wrote from Kairouan, Tunisia, and he is writing to Jews in Egypt, to his relative in Egypt. He is one of the Gaonim about there's the legend that he was captured by pirates, Arab pirates, and ransomed off by the community in Kairouan. It's not clear from this letter that he was there in an involuntary way. It sounds like he was willingly settled there. But either way, it's a fascinating, ancient letter. What else do we have? So we have here, you've heard of Dunash ibn Lebret, who was the great
Yes.
poet who wrote Dror Yikra Levanim Bat. So evidently he had to escape Spain and he went to Egypt. And here's a letter that his wife wrote to him with a beautiful poem writing to her husband in poetic form. She was also a poet. This is virtually the only piece of poetry we have from a medieval woman. And it's just beautiful. And talking about how she when he leaves, will he now come back to Spain if the prince gives him half the kingdom? We don't know what really
Look
happened.
at this, but just one second here. He put a ring on her and
Yes.
she put a bracelet on him. What's going on there?
Well, they were exchanging mementos.
Was that at the Chasana?
No. This is when he
It
left her.
sounds like a double ring ceremony, more
No,
than.
this is when he left her.
Oh, okay.
Will her love remember his graceful love, her only son, as he parted when he left her?
On her left hand, he placed a ring from his
On his
right.
right.
That sounds like Kedushin.
No. This is a poem. They were married for years. They already had a child at this point, as you can see in the poem. Right? Now, the bracelet is more than likely her dowry, which she's giving him because he is escaping for his life
Got
and
it.
probably needs the money.
Yeah.
So that's very likely. In any case, just some interesting insights. Here's a letter to Chasdai ibn Shafrut, who is a Jewish diplomat in Spain, and it talks about the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism. There were some a number of
During real
letters.
time.
Yeah, there are a number of letters from the Khazars to the Jews in Spain and Egypt.
These are not like talking about ancient history. These are happening in real time.
It's a few hundred years after the conversion, but yeah, Solomon Schechter published those letters. It made front page news in the New York Times about an ancient Jewish kingdom in Khazaria, which Solomon Schechter has called the Schechter Letters. Here's a prenup, like a ksuva, but it's got a number of conditions which are fascinating. It's a guy's name is Tuvia, and he has accepted Anit Tuvia. Right, accepted upon myself that I will not bring into my house frivolous jesters, good for nothings. I will not enter the house of anyone who clings to licentiousness, corruption, and ugly deeds. I will not associate with them for food or drink or anything else, and I will not purchase for myself a slave girl as long as Faiza is with me. So evidently, this guy had a little bit of a reputation. And his wife is not willing to marry him unless he signs a condition, a prenup, that A, he will not have frivolous jesters, buffoons, and licentious men, in other words, his friends, cannot come
Yes.
to the house, and he cannot
Yes.
hang out with them. And
Yes.
this is one very common condition that we find was he cannot purchase a slave girl for obvious reasons.
Yes.
Here, we just celebrated Hanukkah, where we date documents from the reign of Alexander. The Talmud says, as a tribute to Alexander for not destroying the temple, we dated documents from his reign. So here's a document from Cairo. It's a ketuvah, and you can see that it's dated back to the reign of Alexander.
Now, it's actually referred to as Fostat.
Fostat, yes, as you can see, Fostat. Mitzrayim, Egypt, Sha'al Nilus Hanahar on the Nile River.
So you are saying that Fostat is identical with Cairo.
Fostat is type of a suburb of Cairo. I think nowadays
Okay.
it's called Old Cairo, but that's where the Rambam and many Jews lived in Fostat.
Okay.
And here you've got another ketuvah, which is, as you can see, very nicely made. Right? Here's a letter, 1048. A letter written by Jews in Ramla, Israel, asking for funding because there was an earthquake, and things were going. There were it says bodies lying in the streets. There is disease and so on and so forth. It's a very tragic letter. Here's another ketuvah, which in which there's a rabbinite Jew marrying a Karaite woman, which is fascinating. And it says in the ketuvah, he will not compel his wife to sit with him in the light of the Sabbath lamp, because the Karaites would always sit in the dark on Shabbos, nor to eat the fatty tail, because we actually eat the alya, the tail of a sheep. The Karaites consider it chaylev, and will not profane her religious festivals as long as she also observes his festival. This is a complicated way.
I was not aware of this. They had different festivals.
Yes, because they their calendar was different. They had the same festivals that we have, but different dates because they calculated
I see.
differently.
So they had Sukkot just at a different time of year. They didn't have their own holidays that we
You can
don't have.
imagine this marriage was quite interesting. She'd be sitting in the dark, they'd be eating cold food. They'd keep two sets of Yom Tovim, sometimes overlapping. It's like bizarre. And it's signed by rabbis and Karaites.
So this is 11th century.
Pre-Rambam's arrival, when the Rambam came, he forbade the marriage to Karaites.
I seem to remember, because I over the years got to meet some Egyptian Jews, and I seem to remember that even up until a lot of them are leaving after Nasser takes over, that there were lots of Karaites there. In fact, if somebody said that they were from a Jewish family that was in Egypt for a long time, you had to check into that to make sure that they were not Karaites. So that this would be like many hundreds of years that they had Karaites
Correct.
that were prominently a part, it looks like prominently a part of the Jewish community, or at least until the Rambam.
Correct. And here is an original handwritten manuscript by Maimonides in his own handwriting of his commentary on the Mishnah with a picture that he drew as well. And there are literally volumes of his commentary on the Mishnah with his handwriting.
Now, it's really my understanding is his commentary is written in Hebrew letters, but it's actually Arabic.
What we call Judeo-Arabic. It is Arabic with lots of Hebrew thrown in, written in Hebrew letters. And this is in the Rambam's own handwriting. Here is his notebook that he used to plan the Mishneh Torah. This is actually found in Oxford University. As you can see, he's got the title, the heading. He's got Perek Rishon. This is his handwriting. He's got little notes in the side. He's crossed out things. He's rewritten things. He's changed the order of things. And this is in the Rambam's own handwriting.
Now, another thing, I seem to remember that he was young when he began this
Yeah, he was about 20.
commentary. So, is this an indication that he went back and reworked it? Or is this, do you think, from his youth?
I don't know. I think it's from his youth. The Mishneh Torah is later. This is a letter he wrote as a recommendation for a cousin of his called Yitzhak Aldari, who was moving somewhere, and he wanted Rambam to testify that he was a scholar and hence exempt from taxes. And here is his signature. Right, Shlomo Yirbeh, Shlomo Chaver, Beno, Shalom Bena, right, may his peace increase. Moshe ben Rav Maimon Zatzal, Moses son of Maimon. Here's a receipt for money that he gave for redemption of captives. Here's a close-up of his signature, Moshe ben Rav Maimon Zatzal. Maimon is his father, so Zatzal.
That's sort of very interesting. So that's the Rambam. Is that a pic? You just put up a picture of the Rambam from his youth.
Ah, well, this is me
Yes.
holding a
Oh, I
letter.
thought that was the Rambam. It's
That's
you?
actually that they
Okay.
store the letter in a special type of plastic, and it's open to the. It's not hermetically sealed. It's actually open to the air. So for some reason, that's better for preservation of the document. But it was pretty cool to hold a letter written by Maimonides with his signature on it.
Now, did he write with a quill? Is that
Yes.
the assumption? He wrote with a
Yes, he
quill.
wrote the quill. In fact, there is a professor at Sorbonne whose expertise is the actual physical manuscripts, medieval physical manuscripts. And she actually also, she said he was writing with a quill. Here's a section of his Mishneh Torah. Again, you can see he's crossed out things, he's rewritten things, he's inserted things in the text. And it's not, it's just interesting. You could probably, if you'd read this, you could see a little bit of his thought process in writing it. Here's one classic example. You can see he's got the word Hilchot Nezikin, laws of damages. The word Nezikin is crossed out, and he's rewritten laws of Nizkei Mamon, damaged by property. So he's even careful that with the title of the chapter, he's careful about, right? There you go. There's a little piece from the Mishneh Torah. Here is just a lexicon. He's translating words, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. This is from the Guide for the Perplexed, and you can see he's written a pasuk here by Yishkon Kvod Hashem al Har Sinai. Right, that's a verse from the Torah. The rest is in Judeo-Arabic.
So he wrote Hashem with two yuds.
Yeah, so Rav Moshe Shapiro
That's
says
interesting.
that the use of two yuds is because it's the first letter of the way it's written, Yud Hey and Vav Hey.
Yeah.
Last letter of the way it's pronounced, Adonai, Yud.
Oh, I see.
First letter of the writing, last letter of the pronunciation, you've got the name of Hashem. That's Moshe Shapiro's
No, I didn't
explanation.
realize how old that was.
It is
because
pretty
when
crazy.
we were wee lads, that's how Sidurim and other kinds
Yeah.
of they all
I
had
always thought it was the way
yuds.
the printers wanted to save ink, and
Yeah.
which may be, it may be
Right.
true, but it's pretty
But I
old.
would have thought it was very modern.
This is one
That's
of my
cool.
favorite pieces. This is Maimonides' doodle. Can you see the doodle right
On
now?
the top left,
No, in the middle on the left.
that's what I
Middle.
mean. I meant whatever. Yeah.
Right.
So it looks like a E. I would say it looks like a G in the middle, a script G.
Yeah, but it's a doodle.
And it's possible he's writing an early form of English. Is that, I'm sure that's what people are assuming.
It's a doodle. It's a doodle. Anyway, so you have here's a letter from someone who visited the Rambam. Talks about how he visited to deliver a document, and the Rambam took his son and played, had told his son to play with this guy's son and explained him the document, served him lemon cake, which he said the Rambam liked lemon cake. I can already see a few similarities between myself and Maimonides. I doodle, I like lemon cake. So there you go. That's right. Here's a section from.
I can't think of so far anything, but I'll try to catch up with you
Okay.
when you
That's
mention
all,
it.
that's from the that's a, an old mezuzah found in the Cairo
Oh,
Geniza.
there it is. All the angel names.
Exact, which obviously the Rambam says is pasul, is absolutely invalid, but this is a mezuzah from his time in the Cairo Geniza with the names of angels written on the
They're
side.
not even, I'll be honest, the handwriting is not that impressive.
It's not. And here you got Magen David's, one of the earliest instances of Magen David.
Oh, interesting. Now, why were they there? What
I
was a
think just a
Magen David?
decoration. I really don't know.
Was it a mystical symbol?
Gershon Sholem, I think, feels it was mystical. Yeah. Here's the letter, the last letter from David, the Rambam's brother, to David from a place called Aydab in Sudan, where he went on the boat. His boat sunk and he drowned. The Rambam writes that it was the single saddest event of his entire life was the loss of his brother. And here is the brother wrote a letter to him. David wrote a letter to his brother from Sudan.
Now, not to suggest that they weren't close. I'm sure they were very personally close, but also the Rambam's lifestyle was afforded by his wealthy merchant
Correct.
brother because he was able to devote himself to his studies while he was being supported by his brother. And then once his brother passed away, he had to shift to doing a lot more doctoring.
Correct, correct. But it's interesting. So there was the pragmatic aspect. He had to support his own family and his brother, but he
Yeah.
actually writes that for a year afterwards, he was so depressed it was difficult for him to get out of bed.
Yeah, so that's a
Every
lot
time
more
he'd
than
see
just, yeah.
something, in his brother's handwriting, he'd burst into tears.
Which
So,
you do not associate that with the Rambam. He has his reputation as somebody who's coldly philosophical, complete master over his character and feelings.
but
And
he
there
was a
you see, he's a human being.
human being. Here's the letter. Here's the it's obviously fragments because it was, as you can saw from the manuscript, there were pieces missing. But this is what he writes. Very sad to see it. Here's a tshuva written by the Rambam's son, Avraham, son of the Rambam. And there's quite a few manuscripts from the Rambam's son in the Cairo Geniza. This is a song. A poem written by someone by the name of Giovanni or Johann from Italy, who converted to Judaism and became known as Ovadia, and he moved to Cairo and composed a song. There's another Ovadia who turns up in the
This is
Rambam's
not the same
letters.
one. You're
No,
saying this is not the same one?
not the same one.
Ovadia Hager?
Ovadia in the Rambam's letters was a convert from Islam. This Ovadia was a Catholic from Italy. But Ovadia was not an uncommon name for converts because Ovadia himself, the prophet Ovadia, was a convert.
Right.
We actually have, these are the notes, sheet music that was found in the.
No way.
And actually, it has been.
That is awesome.
Israeli scholars have actually, and musicians have actually figured out what it sounds like, what that music.
Oh my gosh.
But that is pretty awesome to hear what Jews were listening to, the music in Cairo. Here's a Yiddish letter, one of the oldest Yiddish letters ever. A woman in Europe writing to her son in Cairo, and it starts off by saying, "Why don't you write?"
Any idea what year this might have been?
Here's a letter from Yehuda Halevi to his friend Chalfon. So this is from 1120 or so. And basically asks him to ask a question to Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash,
the Rimigash,
if he ruled correctly. Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rimigash both learnt in yeshiva in Elisena. The Rosh Yeshiva was the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi.
What is Elisena? Where is that?
A place in Spain, southern Spain.
So the Rif would have been there at the end of his life.
Yeah, he established the yeshiva there.
And the Rimigash is the Rambam's
father's
Rebbe.
Yeah. There's the address. It's the name of the recipient and the city in which he lives. How it got to him is a good question. I don't know. But this is awesome. This is a kashrut certification to Hechsher for a cheese store in Egypt. 11th, 12th century. The cheese store is run by Karaites, and the Beit Din of Cairo, the rabbis in Cairo, ensured that the Karaites, by a handshake and an oath on the Torah, would only use cheese, kosher cheese, and import it specifically kosher, and so on and so forth. And it's a letter, this is the OU from 900 years ago. How unbelievable is that?
That's incredible.
This is like you'd walk into a Karaite cheese store, and on the wall is this letter, which certifies that the products in the store are kosher.
And it's like 900 years ago.
Yeah. Here's Kaddish, which actually has the Yatzmach.
No? Oh, so it's Nusach Sfard.
Yeah, and it also includes the names of rabbis.
Oh, look at that.
The Chayechon of Yomechon. Uvechaye Adonenu Eviatar HaKohen Rosh HaYeshiva, in the life of Eviatar the Kohen, head of the Yeshiva, Gaon Yaakov. Uvechaye Rabbeinu Shloma Avi HaYeshiva, the master of the Yeshiva. Uvechaye Rabbeinu, and it lists a whole bunch of rabbis in the Kaddish.
In the Kaddish.
Yeah.
Now, I seem to remember that this was the case also with benching during the time of the Rambam. Is that the case? Do you know?
I don't know about benching, but the Ramban, in his famous letter to quieten the argument about the writings of the Rambam, he writes, attesting to the greatness of the Rambam, he says, "I know that Jews from Yemen mention the Rambam in their Kaddish.
Oh, and Kaddish.
The
Right, okay.
Chaya Marana v'Rabbana Rav Moshe ben Maimon. That's in the that was in the Yemenite Kaddish. That's quoted
Got
by the Ramban.
it.
Here is a Haggadah from Egypt, 11th century. First of all, notice, see the big arrow there? Baruch
Yeah.
atah, right after Kiddush, Hazmanim. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, sha'asa nisim la'avoteinu bayamim ha'elu.
Nice.
They added that bracha.
How do you like that?
And five questions. Shebechol ha'leilot anu ochlim basar tzli shalukum. All other nights we eat all types of meat. Halayla hazeh hayinu ochlim beveit hamigdash kulot. On this night we only ate in the Beit HaMikdash, we only ate roasted meat. So that was the five questions. There's Birkat HaMazon, 10th century Israeli version. Very, very brief, as you can see. It's a short version.
Why are they calling it a Palestinian version?
Well, it was Palestine at the time, but
Oh,
people,
it came from Israel.
yeah, came from Israel.
Oh, I see.
That's one of the Schechter letters from the
Uh-huh.
Karaites. Yeah, that talking about
Any idea what percentage of Jews at that time identified as Karaites?
we don't know. No.
Did it seem like a lot to you, based on your
It's
research?
hard to know. They did disappear. They assimilated into the Jewish community and non-Jewish community. But here's, by the way, a letter from Kiev to the Jews in Cairo, and it's got written in Karaite script at the bottom. I have read this. Hokurum. And it's also got name Karaite Jewish names in the letter as well.
I didn't realize that there was a Karaite script.
Called
So
Turkic.
is it version, it looks like an aleph there. A
It does look a little like, I don't know if
little
it's
bit.
related. I don't know if it's Semitic.
Yeah. Interesting.
These are the coolest things, I think, from the Kaggadah. These are children's workbooks from 900 years ago in Egypt, teaching Aleph Beit and teaching the Nekudot. And you can see they made an effort to make them look good.
Yeah.
And even more awesome, the kids' work themselves. These are the things that the kids wrote.
And doodles.
Ah, so here's one kid. He's a doodler, this kid.
Yeah,
His
clearly
terrible.
watch TV, because that's clearly a picture of a TV
Well,
right up there at
that's a
the top.
person on a camel.
That looks
Those,
more
I
like a
think,
TV to me.
those triangular things are stirrups. Those are classic stirrups. There's a book in YU Library about cavalry and stuff at that time in Egypt, believe it or not. And they had triangular stirrups for the.
Imagine that that's your area of expertise.
It's
You've spent
mind-boggling.
years and years and years, and you've become the expert on doodling stirrups.
Well, here's the other kid. This kid's the nerd. He's going to get beaten up at recess. And here's a kid who's doodled a Nile boat with the sun. Now, I actually also, there's a book about medieval boats of the Middle
Yeah.
East
Yeah.
and the library, and I looked it up, and that is an accurate depiction of a Nile River boat.
So I remember years ago, you showed me this or something like it, or I saw whatever you had been doing years ago. And I was mentioning that when, even in Israel, if you ask an Israeli, like my kids when they were growing up, if you ask them to draw a house, they draw slanted, like a roof. Yeah, like roofs that are slanted. Now, clearly, this is a boat. This is not a house, but it's interesting to me because in Israel, you don't experience that. For the most part, they are rectangular houses. They are not sloped roofed, but that looks like sloped roofs. But again, that may not be any
That's accurate.
indication of
It's
what
accurate
house.
depiction of
Yeah,
a book. Yeah.
that's cool.
Here's a business letter from Rabbi
Look
Yosef
at that
Charan,
handwriting.
author. Well, I don't think it's his handwriting. I think it was written by a professional scribe. It's demand for payment of a loan. Here's his signature right here. So it looks like it was written by a professional scribe. There's his signature.
Nice.
author of the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law. Here's a full view of the letter. Here is a business letter from the Arizal. Rabbi Yitzhak Luria was living in Cairo. As you know, he was lost his father. His mother moved with him to Cairo, where he was. They were raised by his uncle, who was very wealthy, and he worked for him for a while.
Do you know what he? What did he do?
It was a merchant of some sort. This is a business letter, and he used to own. He owned an island in the Nile Delta, a small island, where the Arizal used to go and meditate on the Zohar in that island. On that island.
This is obviously before he moves to Sfat.
Yes, correct.
Now, where did they originally live? You said they moved to
Israel. They moved to Cairo from Israel.
Really?
There's the Arizal signature.
So how did he do that?
That's a cool signature, I got to say, as you would expect.
Now, just step back for a second, because the Rambam had to give an entire explanation for why he's allowed to live in Egypt during that time.
The Rambam never explains why he's living in Egypt.
Didn't he? Well, I mean, maybe not explains it, but didn't he write somewhere that he's over on Shnei Lavin?
There is a story Haparchi, who wrote a book, Kaftor Vaferach, a late Rishon, about the laws of Israel, says he was in Cairo and he met a descendant of the Rambam who showed him a letter of the Rambam, which the Rambam writes, "I transgress prohibitions every day." Problem is, we have many letters from the Rambam in his handwriting from Cairo. Not a
and
single
he doesn't
one
write
says
it.
That. Not a single one says that.
Got
So,
it.
so it's unclear, right? And the Rambam doesn't explain why. There is lots of discussion about it, but the Rambam doesn't talk about it. No.
Got it. Got it.
Here is an inventory of you know what's in the Cairo Gniza, like. Just for example, if you look here, Cambridge University's got 198,000 fragments.
Wow.
The British Library, 10,000. John Rylands University, Manchester, 11,000. New York Jewish Theological Seminary, which is where Solomon Schechter moved from Cambridge, 30,000.
Yeshiva University has two.
We have two. Yes, we have two. What can I say? It's a little embarrassing, but that's what we have. Oxford, 25,000 pieces. All right, so they're all over the world, over the world. And what's there which is still to be published? There's a lot of stuff which is being published. There's responsa of Avraham, son of Maimonides. We have students' notes of the Rambam's lectures on Talmud and philosophy, which are written in Arabic. And students' notes of the lectures of Riri Migash. So that's pretty fascinating stuff. And I'm sure there's more things there which need to be discovered and which have not yet been found. So it's quite something.
There was a guy who came to Or Sameach when I was teaching there. He came during the summer. Mayor Schuster found him at the Kotel, brought him to Or Sameach. And Mayor Schuster had pitched to him that he could learn Hebrew. It was during the summer break, and there were Ulpan classes happening at Or Sameach. And he pitched to this guy, and this guy said, you know, he doesn't really have money to spend on that, but he's willing to barter. He'll teach whoever teaches him, he'll teach that person Arabic, and the person will teach him Hebrew. So I got to be that person. So he taught me how to read Arabic and, you know, a lot of Arabic words. But one of the things that he used, this again, he's just studying Arabic. His PhD was like in Arabic literature from University of Texas. And like a princess from Jordan was in his class, and you know he had all he wasn't a from guy at all. I mean, he was just like, but we had this primer, and in the introduction to the primer, it mentioned that there are three stages of Arabic. There's classical Arabic, there's Middle Arabic, and then there's like modern Arabic. And the Middle Arabic, where it moves, that's the biggest jump in Arabic, where it moves from the like sort of classical Arabic to the middle, you know, to. So it says in there, this is not a Jewish book, it just says that a big resource for Middle Arabic are the writings of the Rambam.
Huh. Interesting.
that he, because he was very prolific and he was writing at that time, and so not just as a, he wasn't just influential as a philosopher, but even the Arabic language, the Rambam was
Fascinating.
influential. Yeah.
That's amazing. Amazing. So, yeah, that's great. So that's a little bit of an intro.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a book by Solomon Goitien from Princeton University, which is 8 volumes, called A Mediterranean Society, which describes life on the shores of the Mediterranean, based almost exclusively on the Cairo Geniza.
I was at a museum that was in, that's on the University of Chicago campus. It's actually a fairly interesting museum because it's just small, but they have real artifacts. So they have a facsimile of a page that the Rambam wrote about his schedule.
Oh, yes, famous letter. Yeah. All right. So the originals of these are in the places which we saw: Oxford, Cambridge, Jewish Theological Seminary, etc. It's incredible stuff. There was a recently an exhibit last year. Oxford lent an exhibit to Wat Yeshiva University, so we were able to see a lot of the stuff, the original writings of the Rambam and his copies, Mishneh Torah, his co commentary on the Mishnah. Amazing, amazing stuff to see. And there are, new insights coming out all the time. And obviously, this is going to lead us to the question that you wanted
Right.
to discuss, which we're not going to have time to do.
Right. But let's say the Frankel Rambam. I remember when they started to work on the Frankel Rambam. So the Frankel Rambam is the Mishneh Torah. That was their project. And this was already being done like 45 years ago, maybe 50 years ago. They started this
I
project.
remember when they were doing it. Yeah.
And there was this group of scholars who were who gained access to all different manuscripts, and they were trying to come up with a correct manuscript of Mishneh Torah, the to the best of their ability. And I don't know of specific instances, but I remember at the time there was some controversy because there were contradictions in the Rambam, which had become the foundation for learned discussion and discourse that were resolved because somebody found the original or a very early text. And what everybody thought was just the Rambam writing a different opinion was just a mistake, a copy mistake by somebody. And that once they got these earlier texts, they realized there is no contradiction. And so I don't know if there was ever a Reb Chaim, like one of those on that level, a resolution by somebody like Reb Chaim of a steer in the Rambam, but a contradiction in the Rambam. But I do remember that that was part of the controversy. What are we to do about these texts? What is the status of these texts where scholars, I mean, these were real scholars. I remember Ramosha Hirschler was one scholar that we knew. He had been in Chicago. He was at one point the acting Rosh Yeshiva of Skokie Yeshiva, but he was a massive Talmud Chacham. Yeah. And
Which
so
is
you
pretty
had people
restrained.
like that. All these kind of people are working on these man on all these kinds of manuscripts. I don't know. I don't think he was working on the Frankel Rambam, but he's working on different manuscripts. And so when we get these, like the Ritva, they did a lot of work on the Ritva with all sorts of annotations, and a lot of the Rishonim, where you have work with annotations, and they're working with different, but especially the Rambam. And I know there was controversy at that time.
Well,
What is your understanding about it?
there's a few aspects to that controversy. Number one, it's like almost like a very nuanced philosophical debate. When rabbis like Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and others give their explanations of the Rambam, do we assume that's what the Rambam thought? That's what he had in mind? Did he have in mind Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's two dinim? Or is that does that exist independently? In other words, the Rambam is a vehicle by which we can understand Torah, And I don't know if we're claiming that the Rambam had that in mind when he wrote it, right? That's what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik understood from the Rambam, and it's a legitimate understanding of Torah, if not necessarily what the Rambam meant. So I
So
don't know. So I'm
you're
saying that's
saying
sort of
you're saying
debatable. It's accurate.
even if that wasn't the original text, it's still Torah, is
Exactly. In
what you're
other words,
saying.
there is that idea. There's a
Yeah.
second aspect to the controversy, which the Chazon Ish and others discuss, which I guess we'll talk about next week,
Yeah.
which is a manuscript that was not tachat yadayim, was not under the scrutiny and study of great Torah scholars for 1,000 years, and just came out of the closet, was lifted out of the
Like
dirt.
from the Vatican.
Now,
Like suddenly the Vatican produces a manuscript. Nobody's
exactly.
seen this for a
Does
thousand
it
years.
change? Now, does it change the number of Rishonim who believe this? Is it now, will it change? The Chazon Ish was the opinion that it's irrelevant.
We don't even, do we
We
learn
don't
it?
learn it because it's fascinating, but it doesn't change the halacha because it was not a manuscript that was the divine providence had placed under the scrutiny of Torah scholars.
So you're saying that's a Chazon Ish, because I heard this in the name of the Beis HaLevi. Did you also hear
I
this
did not
at
hear
the
it in the base.
Soloveitchik's?
I
No.
heard it was a Chazon Ish. It's
That there's
certainly,
like a Siyata Dishmaya.
it
There's
would
like
make
a,
sense,
yeah.
yeah. All right, there's a third area, a third aspect of this whole question, which is even broader than that, which again we'll talk about next week, which is archaeology. Does data, archaeological data, will that affect halachic opinion?
For instance, what is Tcheles?
That will be one example, right? What
Yeah.
is tchelet? What is that color purple, or the blue that we have on tzitzit? What about the existence of walls around towns regarding reading Megillah? The weights and measures, biblical weights and measures, which has ramifications in terms of halacha today, right? Of course, there's the whole controversy about tefillin. Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi and the order of parchments in the tefillin. Do we have ancient tefillin that indicate one way or the other? And if they do, does it make a difference? Size
There's
of the mikvah,
certainly famous stories about it, whether
size and
they're
construction.
real.
Yeah, size and constructions of mikvahs. All these are important questions and are discussed at length by some major halachic authorities, all the way from the Ramban, all the way down to Chazon Ish today, and the Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and others, and that is something which is, I think, a fascinating
But
subject.
you could have a just based on what you've said up until now, you could have a circumstance. This is highly theoretical, but let's say somebody found Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillin, but nobody, everybody agrees after the fact that these are Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillin, but they have not been seen up until now, and it could be the Chazon Ish is going to say, you can't use these to determine the halacha about a detail of tefillin.
Interesting. Yeah, does he say it about that? He says it about manuscripts. Could you accept the tefillin is unclear, but I'll give you one example where there's an argument in the Gemara as to whether the tzitz, the plate on the forehead of the Kohen Gadol or the high priest, Kodesh Lashem, holy unto God, is that on one line or two lines? So the Gemara has an argument about it. And Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi, says he saw it in Rome. He saw the tzitz in Rome. Josephus says there was a palace called the Palace of Peace, which was where the Romans kept the loot that they got in war and on display. It's a very Orwellian, right? The Palace of Peace, the Temple of Peace. And the rabbis saw things there. So Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yossi actually saw the tzitz in Rome, and it was all on one line, he says. The Rambam does not paskin that way. The
Really?
Rambam rules that it's on two lines. That's the Rambam paskins. He says, Kodesh Lashem, Kodesh Milamata, Lashem Milamala. He says, however, if you wrote it on one line, this is what the Rama says, if you wrote it on one line, it's kosher. Sometimes they wrote it on one line. So he's acknowledging that, yeah, but that's not how we pass. In other words,
that's funny.
That it's fascinating because he saw, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi saw that sits in Rome. And the Rambam Paskins, very nice. Sometimes they wrote it that way. That's not how we rule. And he's ruling independent of that. So again, there's a lot of different opinions and discussion about
this. We'll talk about that.
The great letter by Rav Huttner about it. There's
I look forward to it.
Okay, so God willing, Be'ezrat Hashem, inshallah, next week.
Inshallah.
Right, again, I'm not sure if, maybe you have to say that. I don't know. In any case,
God willing. I'll cover us on that. You go with the regular.
Folks, if you like this, then like.
Press like
and share it. Tell
and spread the word.
It. I was talking to a close relative of mine today. She says, oh, you got a podcast? I said, oh, my God. Unbelievable. Yes.
Did she believe you after you said yes?
Yes, she actually, she searched and then she believed
me. She believed you. Yeah. She didn't believe you right away.
Not immediately.
I get that.
No,
I get that. Okay.
So folks, share it with others. Tell people.
Yes, please do. And again, this sometimes it really does add a great deal to watch it on YouTube. A lot of them, it doesn't make much of a difference because it's mostly we're just talking about ideas. But in this particular one, Mordechai has a lot of fascinating photographs that accompany this discussion. So this one in particular would be worthwhile.
Oh, and also, I think Torah Anytime, you can also see the visual.
Oh, and Torah Anytime does that?
Torah Anytime, I'm pretty sure,
cool.
Also has the visual.
Okay, cool. All right, okay. So then you don't have to go on YouTube, Chas V'Shalom.
Okay, folks.
All right.
Good to see
you. Be well.
Bye-bye.